Orans. Not this. Go round. Damascus, Orans. Damascus.
No prisoners.
Orans.
This was Talal's village.
Talal! Talal! No prisoners! No
prisoners! Scholarship in the service of empire. The legacy of Anne K. Islamton in 20th century Iran.
My name is Iskander Sadiq Burjerdi, and I'm currently a British Academy postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Oxford. Anne K. Islamton stands alongside the great Orientalists of the 20th century, who dedicated her many decades of erudition to the study of Iran's history, both medieval and modern. Her life and scholarship, however, raises uncomfortable questions about the formation of Iranian studies and its academic practice. Here we examine the extent to which her legacy is intertwined with the politics of empire out of which it both developed and whose interests it has been geared to serve. Born in Newmarket, England in 1912, Lambton, known to her friends as Nancy, was born into the English aristocracy, the granddaughter of the second Earl of Durham, no less. She rose to the heights of British academic life, becoming chair of Persian at the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, in 1953, where she had obtained her undergraduate degree in 1935 and PhD in 1939, under the supervision of Sir Edward Denison Ross. While a young student, she was mentored by Orientalist luminaries like Sir Hamilton Gibb, Sir Harold Bailey, Vladimir Minorsky, and Arthur Tritton. During her first travels to Iran in the 1930s, she made the acquaintance of Surah Israfil, the philosopher, literatus, statesman Muhammad Ali Furughi, the inimitable lexicographer Ali Akbar Dehkhodar, and had even been taught Persian by Sayyid Hassan Taghizadeh, another distinguished scholar, statesman, and participant in the Constitutional Revolution. During World War II, Lambton worked in the British legation as press attaché to the British ambassador, Sir Reader Bullard. Despite her deep respect for him, Lambton acknowledged Bullard's belief in Persian deviousness in the obituary she wrote for him in 1977. As Shaul Bakhash has argued, Lambton wrote a memorandum to Bullard on the 1st of May 1941, which had deeply influenced British thinking regarding the fate of Reza Shah. In her analysis, Lambton stated that British support for the Shah would prove fatal in the event of a German invasion. As a result, Bullard concluded that unless the Shah was removed, the majority of Iranians might welcome a German invasion due to the Shah's widespread identification with British machinations. 3 weeks into the Allied occupation, Eden and Churchill finally endorsed the decision to remove the monarch. Lambton is credited with authoring the BBC Persian Service's famous broadcast savaging Reza Shah and enumerating the myriad abuses of power which had occurred under his rule following the Allied invasion and occupation of the country in August 1941. Some have speculated that this broadcast in particular sparked the king's abdication.
Gurkha infantry and other empire troops enter Kermanshah as from south and west Britain sends forces into Iran. The Axis poisoned country of the recently abdicated Shah was once a happy hunting ground for Nazi agents. The peaceful invasion is watched with interest by Iranian soldiers as our forces pass in long columns through the towns to make contact with the Russians coming down from the north. Near the town of Kazvin, the two columns meet, and the long Allied front reaching from the Arctic to Libya is joined. British and Russian commanders shake hands, and the soldiers of Great Britain and the Soviet Union meet for the first time. Across Iran, three times the size of France, roll the mechanized forces of the Allies, while the people of this ancient land look on with seeming indifference. In the capital city of Tehran, life goes on much the same.
In the course of the war, she worked for the Ministry of Information and was aware of the Special Operations Executive's activities. During this period, she became acquainted with the Anglophile operatives, the Rashidian brothers, and essentially oversaw propaganda and public relations in support of the Allies, forging ties with Iranians from all walks of life and across the political spectrum. For her assiduous service, she would be awarded the OBE, Officer of the Order of the British Empire, in 1941. She came to confidently speak of a Persian mind, Persian mentality, and believed in Iranians' incapacity for independent thought. The Persian, she held, had no concept of the individual.
5 hours later, with the mood of the people hardly changed, Iran's leader was finally laid to rest below a screaming crowd of mourners. Scenes that once again showed the frenzy the Ayatollah could generate both in life and in death.
He was not just a political or spiritual leader, his word was law, not just to Iranian hardline fundamentalists, but all across the Middle East. Today, Western politicians will be giving thanks that no matter who succeeds the Ayatollah, he's unlikely to achieve that sort of power. Peter Sharp, News at 10 in Tehran.
After the war, Lampton's first lectureship at SOAS was funded by the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, known today as British Petroleum, BP. She played a vital role in training its employees, as well as British Council representatives, FCO staff waiting to be dispatched to Tehran and Afghanistan, military personnel and businessmen. The AIOC regularly sought her advice and solicited her policy recommendations. Her seminal work, Landlord and Peasant in Persia, was published in 1953 and remains a unique document on the development of agrarian life and relations from the 8th century till the modern period. Her most infamous moment came with her implacable opposition to the nationalist government of Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, who had nationalized Iranian oil in 1951. Her colonial contempt for the European-educated aristocrat, as well as her inability to appreciate that Iranians might be capable of national consciousness, she did appear to reconsider this 3 decades later, led her to revile him and his program. Iranians were prohibited from asserting their sovereign rights and nationalizing their country's most vital natural resource. It was an affront to the empire. The only way compromise might be achieved was through the overthrow of old Mossi, as many in the diplomatic service referred to him. Demonstrating the great synergy of prejudice shared by old Orientalists like Lampton, the Foreign Office and Western media, Mossadegh was invariably described as impervious to reason, fanatical, obstinate, and menacing. What was fashioned for public consumption in Western capitals in its stead was an infantilized, absurd, irrational, yet cunning and mendacious Oriental without rhyme or reason.
Iran's British-hating Premier Mossadegh arrives in Cairo, where he gets a rousing welcome by 20,000 British-hating Egyptians.
Lampton fiercely advocated for the overthrow of Mossadegh's government and had the ear of the Conservative Foreign Secretary, Sir Anthony Eden, who, as it happened, had read Persian Arabic at Oxford. As historian Ervand Abrahamian has noted, it was at this juncture that she strongly urged the Foreign Office to keep a steady nerve and wait for Mossadegh to fall. She insisted, "Our own unofficial efforts to undermine him are making good progress. If we agree to discuss the compromise with him, the effort will strengthen him." She added that Americans who talk of compromise are wrong and do not have the experience or psychological insight. Her dogmatic belief in Iranian's unwieldy irrationalism was indissociable from her advocacy of a hawkish and predatory policy, the aftermath of which has left an indelible and traumatizing impact on the polity till this day.
Abadan, the world's largest oil refinery, which British enterprise and money built, may pass out of British control if Persia carries out the vote for nationalization passed by their parliament. In the barren, arid mountains of Khuzestan, in land where no crop would grow, in land that was just so much waste to Persia, British prospectors looked for oil, and only after 7 years did they find it in commercial quantities. There were no roads in the wild places where oil was found. They had to be built to carry the heavy equipment to bring the oil to the surface. Huge derricks had to be built to strike the riches of the earth. Huge power plants were needed so that when the derrick was built, there would be power enough to send the cutting bit maybe 2 miles down. A 150 miles to the coast, the oil must be moved. Great pipelines were laid through the mountains, and Abadan, an unknown desert spot, became one of the great oil ports of the world. To thousands of Persians, British enterprise brought well-paid work in good conditions. A vast modern town grew to make life pleasant.
schools for the children, classes to train Persians to do better jobs, hospitals, sanitation, food production units, all these the company provided from the oil shipped abroad. Successive governments in Persia have cooperated with the British. Let us hope that the Persians will not allow themselves to be intimidated by fanatics into a rash act which will lead to disaster for both countries.
By June 1951, Lambton recommended that her friend Robert Charles Zahner return to Iran to reactivate Anglophile saboteur networks, most prominently the dubious Rashidian brothers, to advance British interests and covertly subvert the Mossadegh government from inside the country. Zahner was a fellow Iran scholar based at All Souls College, Oxford, who had served in the secret services during World War II. And as scholar Roger Lewis has argued, the origins of the coup to oust Mossadegh can perhaps be found in the Zahner mission and Lambton's unrelenting efforts. When this didn't prove as efficacious as had been hoped, the Eisenhower administration and the CIA's Kermit Roosevelt stepped in to follow through. In his book, Behind the 1953 Coup in Iran, historian Ali Rahnamar has argued that Lambton may well have stayed at the home of one of the Rashidian brothers during the Mossadegh period and would frequent their residence on later travels. The Anglophile operatives had received ample funds from the British government to subvert Mossadegh and were in her close circle of Iranian friends. She had also been on excellent terms with General Taimur Bakhtiar, the first head of Savak, the Shah's dreaded secret service. Until his fall from grace and flight into exile, he would be assassinated by Savak agents in Iraq in 1970. Mossadegh was finally overthrown in the summer of 1953. Lambton was then responsible for correcting Persian language documents germane to the new oil consortium formed in agreement with the post-coup government of General Fazlullah Zahedi in 1954. These years serendipitously coincided with her becoming chair of Persian at SOAS and her ascent to the apogee of British academic life. Zahner would go on to become Spalding Professor of Eastern Religions and Ethics at All Souls. Following this turbulent period, Lambton continued her research on agrarian reform and had a very real impact on the initial thrust of this aspect of the White Revolution. Throughout the 1960s, she travelled the entirety of the country with the help of Iranian officials, inspecting initiatives that many, including Lambton, believed would create a new class of independent, small-holding peasant farmers. The result of the landforms, however, were highly uneven and predominantly steered towards the mechanization of agriculture and the penetration of industrialized agribusiness into the provinces. Lambton was reportedly greatly disheartened by the eventual tenor of the agricultural reforms, which failed to meet her high hopes. Her poor opinion of the Shah remained intact and was duly reciprocated. It was also in 1964 that she penned a very well-known article on the gathering of Iranian religious and political personalities on the reconsideration of the Shi'i institution of Marjayat, attended by Ayatollahs Murtaza Motahari, Mahmud Taleqani, Muhammad Beheshti, and Mehdi Bazargan, the first prime minister of the Provisional Revolutionary Government following the Islamic Revolution of 1979, amongst others. As a result, some admirers have credited her with predicting the Iranian Revolution of 1979, a somewhat fanciful conclusion which neglects to mention that several Iranian cities had seen major protests on the 5th of June 1963, as news of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini's arrest following his open challenge to the Shah and his White Revolution spread across the country. Lambton was no clairvoyant, but given her interests and proximity to the British foreign policy establishment, she diligently kept up with contemporary developments. She cited the controversy surrounding Khomeini and the implications of the cleric's comparison of the Shah to the execrated Umayyad Caliph Yazid, whose forces slaughtered Imam Hussein, the third Shi'i Imam, and his companions in 680 AD. Her explanation as to why religious forces dominated the protests, however, left much to be desired. Quote, "As long as the fundamental duty of the believer in general and of the religious classes in particular is enjoin what is good and to forbid what is evil, such a religious expression is likely, perhaps always, to be the case."
Again, the free world is troubled by trouble in Iran, regarding with anxiety the rioting and plots said to be aimed at overthrowing Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, a ruler who has long been regarded as one of the West's best friends in the Middle East. Iran is a country of recurring earthquakes, and in 1960 suffered from one of the most violent in the nation's modern history. It brought death and destruction to 200 communities scattered over a wide area and temporarily made untillable hundreds of thousands of agricultural acres, farmlands on which the country's economy greatly depends. Under the personal direction of the Shah, Iran was just recovering from this tragedy when its latest troubles erupted. Ironically, one of the causes of the new rioting was the Shah's land reform program instituted to ease the lot of the country's impoverished peasants at the expense of large landholders. A secondary contributing trouble factor was the Shah's plans for the emancipation of the nation's women. Rioting against this program was led by leaders of a strict Muslim sect opposed to woman suffrage. Shiraz and the holy city of Qom were the scenes of the most violent disturbances, street battling in which 20 were killed and hundreds injured. Iran's army proved loyal to its ruler and in 2 days had the situation in hand. It is one of the best trained and equipped in the Middle East, and more than once has discouraged Kremlin overt acts, though it is now thought that other foreign provocateurs were among the recent troublemakers for His Majesty.
By the late 1960s, she came to refocus most of her attention on the more strictly academic interests with which she had first began, namely the Seljuk period, the topic of her doctoral dissertation, and the history of Islamic political thought. By all accounts, following retirement, Lamptin continued along this path, contributing tens of often obscure and exacting entries to the Encyclopedia of Islam, and pursuing her more arcane research interests well into her 90s. She never returned to Iran following the revolution of 1979. Like Gertrude Bell before her, Lamptin had rebelled against the patriarchal norms of British society and was aided in this endeavor by her aristocratic status and its corresponding class privileges. There is little doubt that she contributed to the study of Iranian history and society, while also being fully complicit and integrated into the capitalist imperial matrix which sought to snuff out the nationalist popular movement and subsequently unleashed a host of destructive repercussions which would resonate for many decades to come. She participated in the abject dehumanization of Iranians and deprived them of meaningful agency, effectively rationalizing their neo-colonial domination. Though one should certainly exercise caution before reducing her many seminal contributions to the mere naked exercise of power and interest. Indeed, such a conclusion might be considered churlish and untrue. It must surely be acknowledged that Lamptin's is a highly vexing and at times vile legacy we should all recall with a critical eye. The legacy of Lamptin and other scholars who have sought to straddle the boundaries of policy making in the metropole and seemingly apolitical scholarly preoccupations is a complex one, whose tensions and contradictions cannot possibly be resolved here. The dangers of instrumentalizing the cultural and intellectual capital of the academy to the end of imperial political and economic objectives should be obvious enough to all. It is, however, a challenge which continues to pose itself to area scholars and the fields they inhabit in the present. Even if its latter-day incarnations may well have changed and evolved in novel and unexpected ways, the likes of Lamptin and her forebears could have not possibly foreseen. Where am I? Annoying.